We simply cannot allow people to pour into the United States undetected, undocumented, unchecked.
And complete the dang fence.
This bill that we will sign today is not a revolutionary bill.
Cast down your bucket where you are.
We come from France.
And I am, adamantly against illegal immigrants.
They're coming in by the thousands. Just unbelievable.
A wall is an immorality.
Who are you rooting for?
Those masters of the universe are at it again.
You maniac! You blew it up!
Welcome to Parsing Immigration Policy, the podcast of the Center for Immigration Studies. My name is Mark Krikorian, Executive Director of the Center. And today we're going to talk about something that's been in the news, and that is state and local activity to limit illegal immigration. Just this week, the Supreme Court temporarily put back on hold a Texas law, which is supposed to go into effect soon, that would make illegally immigrating into Texas, in other words, crossing the Mexican border into Texas, a state crime, which it is not now currently. It's a federal crime as well as a federal civil offense, and would allow the Texas, justice system to punish people or to require that they go back to Mexico to avoid jail. It's a significant piece of legislation, but the point is it's one more piece in Texas's effort to try to compensate for the fact that the Biden administration is refusing to enforce immigration law. And also this week, a bill modeled on the Texas bill in Arizona was vetoed by the Democratic governor in Arizona. So this issue of what can states as well as counties and cities do to try to compensate to some degree for the federal government's refusal to enforce immigration law is in the news. It's definitely an important issue. There's a lot of possibilities, and there's also a lot of actual things happening all across the country in different ways and different places. And I thought the ideal person to discuss this is our own Jessica Vaughn, Director of Policy Studies here at the Center, who has written a good deal about this and, in fact, is speaking to us from the National Sheriffs Association convention in Reno, Nevada. And obviously, the sheriffs at a convention like this, they talk about a lot of things that sheriffs talk about, but also specifically immigration type issues. So Jessica's going to talk not just about that, but also what are the other kinds of things states and localities can do. So Jessica, thanks for joining us. What's it like out in Reno?
Greetings from Reno. They did not get the massive snowstorm that the Sierra Range got, but it's chilly here nonetheless. And also, I just want to mention, it's the Western States Sheriffs Association that's meeting here.
Right.
The national sheriffs just met last month in Washington for their annual meeting, but this is the Western States, and they are perhaps even more focused on border and immigration issues even than the national sheriffs.
Sure.
Because for many of these Western states are border states.
Obviously, yeah. So not to focus specifically either on the sheriff's issue or on the border issue, what kinds of things can states and localities do in response to this crisis created by the Biden administration?
Well, there are a lot of things. As we've said many times, illegal immigration is a huge unfunded mandate on the states because it's the states and local communities that bear the brunt of uncontrolled illegal immigration. And it's important that states try to take action on illegal immigration, not only to push back on what is happening at the federal level and the Biden administration's deliberate border crisis that they've instigated, but also because even if we do get to a point with a new administration that wants to enforce immigration laws and regain control of the border, the federal government can't fix this problem on their own. They really need cooperation from state and local governments. And as we've shown in previous studies by Steve Camerata, the periods of greatest attrition of the illegal populations has come when states were very actively enacting state-based immigration measures,
right,
like Arizona back in the mid-2000s, mid to late 2000s.
Yeah, so basically, in other words, when the federal administration is not doing its job, the states and localities can try to mitigate that. But even when the feds are doing their job, the states and localities can kind of, provide a force multiplier, if you will.
Exactly. Exactly. And states and communities that are concerned about this should try to make their communities kind of zero tolerance locations. And that sends a message to the migrants themselves that they should look elsewhere.
Right.
To live. And that helps mitigate the problem.
In other words, go to New York or Chicago. Don't stay here.
Right. Exactly. So probably the most common or commonly used types of policies have to do with public safety. Like these tend to be the easiest sell politically, right, and the most obvious ones to start with. And that is for communities to insist that local law enforcement agencies are cooperating with ICE and making sure that they're enforcing local laws and, you know, handing over people that ICE wants.
Right.
We track these, of course, with our sanctuary maps so people can see, you know, which jurisdictions in the country are cooperating and which are not. But basically, the idea is for local law enforcement agencies to attack the criminal infrastructure that supports illegal immigration. And I think these are the areas where states and local communities can improve the most. Mm-hmm. For example, by passing tough anti-smuggling laws, as Florida and some other states have done. Florida is actively prosecuting people who transport illegal migrants into the state, and they have a couple of cases pending now. Mm. The states can impose sentencing enhancements on illegal migrants or, you know, prior deportees who commit crimes in the jurisdiction. And they should be going after identity theft, because that is increasingly common nowadays as the illegal migrants want to be able to get jobs and driver's licenses.
Right. Yeah. The ID theft and ID fraud issue is always interesting because some of the things you're talking about here are dealing with people who are regular criminals in the sense of, you know, they're dealing drugs or beating their wives or what have you. But the ID theft and ID fraud issue basically addresses the broader illegal immigration problem, because even some working stiff who's just hanging drywall or washing dishes, he's committing, if he's got a stolen or fraudulent ID, he needs it, obviously, in order to function. And because of that, he's committing a crime that states can address.
Right. And a lot of these of Biden's illegal migrants do have work permits.
Right.
But not all of them. Many of them are absconding from their asylum claim that they made at the border or their gotaways. And so they have no legal means of supporting themselves, and they're going to have to commit ID fraud in order to get employment, right, as in the case of this recent Lake and Riley tragedy in Georgia. Mm-hmm. The woman who was murdered by an illegal alien, his brother was originally questioned because he was near the scene and resembled the person they were looking for, the man who's been accused of their murder. But the brother could be brought into custody and charged himself because he offered a fake green card that he had been trying to use for employment to the officers who arrested him. And that's an easy thing for local officers to use to expose some of these crimes, not only of the people using the ID theft, but the rings that are providing them with the document.
You kind of wonder, it's one of those, you know, sort of dumbest criminals things you see a lot. Presenting your fake ID to the police just strikes me as something that, I mean, maybe he was kind of cornered and had to come up with something, but it just seems like not a great strategy to stay under the radar.
Yeah, but you know, a lot of these illegal migrants, you know, they've been allowed to enter crossing the border illegally, and they must get the impression that we don't actually take, right, some of these laws too seriously. And certainly some jurisdictions do not care about,
right,
that.
Right. Interesting.
So that's one of the problems, really.
Right. So what else in this sort of public safety related kind of category can states or localities do to tighten up their systems?
Well, I think in states that have anti-sanctuary laws, And, you know, where there are some outliers in certain communities that want to buck the policies of the state government, like in Texas, for example, I think it's prudent to also enact, as part of these anti-sanctuary measures, a private right of action for citizens who are harmed by the crimes of an illegal alien who was released by a sanctuary policy to have some recourse in the courts to hold the sanctuary jurisdictions accountable for releasing illegal alien criminals who go on to commit other serious crimes. You know, we're learning that it's hard for the victims of sanctuary policies to get justice or accountability for those policies. The other big thing is there are certain visas, just a couple of them, that actually originate with a certification from a law enforcement agency. And these are visas, the U and T visas, that are available for illegal aliens who are crime victims, mm-hmm. which, as we've discussed on other podcasts, are easily scammed under current very liberal interpretations of the regulations that are now in place. And so state governments and local law enforcement agencies should be very careful about how they certify some of these cases for visas and be aware of the scams that are out there, and that there is no requirement that they actually certify an illegal alien for who's claiming to be a crime victim or a victim of trafficking, except in very serious crimes and severe incidents of trafficking, mm-hmm. and that they don't have to sign off on these if the applicant who's seeking their approval has not been of help in any, you know, real law enforcement case.
Right.
So we've talked more about that in other podcasts and publications, but that is another area that's really ripe for states to take a look at taking action.
And just to make clear, this on these visas, they're sort of kind of like an amnesty visa for illegal alien crime victims, that the certification you're talking about is a necessary precondition. In other words, they don't get the what amounts to an amnesty unless they can get certification from law enforcement agency.
Right. It's one of the few visa programs where local officials are actually the gatekeepers
right.
for this immigration benefit. And so there's, you know, this is one area that they actually can make a difference on. And just to give you a sense of the scale, there are now 300,000 illegal aliens who have applied for
wow.
this. So it's not like an obscure program
right,
anymore.
Right. Just one, before we move on to sort of the next category, I just wanted to underline something about sanctuaries, because the federal government, and this is something the Trump administration had faced, the federal government's not in a position to ban sanctuaries. They can take some steps withholding money and other things, but because the right. states are sovereigns, the federal government can't say to California or to New York City, you are not allowed to be a sanctuary. But at the state level, since all cities and counties are creations of the state law, the states can ban sanctuaries within their own jurisdictions. Is that correct?
Yes, and that's a really good point. It's something they can do. And they're in a better position to do than the federal
right,
government.
Right. So that's the kind of sort of regular law enforcement, kind of the cops and sheriffs role. What is another area that states can act to make their, or even counties or cities, to make their jurisdictions unappealing to illegal aliens?
Well, when we remember that the main reason people are coming here illegally is to work, that means that addressing the job magnet is really probably the most important thing, the most impactful provisions that states should be trying to deal with. And our listeners are all familiar with E-Verify, the federal program that allows employers to verify the authorization of their new hires. And a lot of states have enacted some form of E-Verify mandate. Sometimes it's just for public employers or state agencies, but some states have made it mandatory in the entire state, like South Carolina and now Florida and a number of other states.
And just before you continue, we'll put in the show notes, Numbers USA has a map of the various state requirements, like showing the states and then for whom is E-Verify mandated. We'll put a link to that because it's a pretty useful thing. But like I think you were going to say, is there's more to it. Just passing it is fine, but then what?
Right. It is a great thing to pass it because it's a big deterrent for potential illegal workers, and it works very well in detecting illegal workers. But simply having an E-Verify mandate, I think, is like having a wall on the land border but not patrolling it.
Right.
For E-Verify to really work to its potential, it's important for there to be some compliance requirements, audits on employers, consequences to employers for not enrolling in E-Verify, to really make this work. And South Carolina was the pioneer in this approach. They have a state business license requirement, and they, a number of years ago, passed a requirement that part of the renewal process for business licenses would be an audit of their E-Verify compliance. And so they've achieved really high rates of not just enrollment in E-Verify, but taking a look at employers, you know, that they were actually doing their due diligence on the authorization verification process. And they found a lot of businesses that were cheating on it, not just on hiring illegal workers, but also cheating on payroll tax collection and workers' comp and unemployment insurance and all the other things that go along with scrupulous hiring practices.
Yeah, and that's a point that actually the kind of anti-enforcement, immigration enforcement people bring up often, is that employers hiring illegals are also violating, you know, wage and hour and occupational safety and health rules and all the rest of it. But that doesn't strike me as an argument against E-Verify. That strikes me as an argument for a kind of full spectrum approach to enforcing immigration laws. I mean, not just immigration, but workplace laws. And that E-Verify should be, or well, more generally, the making sure that your workforce is legal should just be a labor standard. Should just be part of normal labor standards, like you don't lock the fire exits, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, just basic stuff. And the problem is that at the federal level, at least under this administration, the Labor Department is like not allowed to refer cases that it finds in its bailiwick of you know, labor laws. If they come across an employer that's, you know, hiring illegals, they're not allowed to really work with ICE in going after that employer from both directions. And it seems to me it's the kind of thing that states can do if they want to be serious about this.
Absolutely. And a lot of this is not only the protection of jobs for legal U.S. workers, but for the protection of illegal workers who are being exploited. You would think the wage and hour people would see the benefit of, you know, working cooperatively with ICE. But you don't see it enough, I think. And that is an authority that state governments have. You know, they can dedicate resources to labor inspections and should be doing that and insisting that there be immigration-related consequences for people. And part of it is because of the explosion in labor trafficking that we've seen as a result of the open borders, where the people coming are not even, you know, paying their full smuggling fee up front a lot of the times. They're kind of selling themselves into debt bondage, you know, to get here, thinking that they will eventually be able to work their way out of it. But it turns out, you know, you never can.
Right, right.
Work your way out of the debt bondage that you end up in.
And so in a sense, to go back to the first category of public safety related, you know, you said one of the things to do is to attack the criminal infrastructure that allows illegal immigration, ID theft and smuggling, what have you. Well, in a sense, wage and hour and other worksite investigations break another part of the criminal infrastructure, where people, illegal immigrants, are basically indentured servants where they have to wash dishes for the next 7 years, that sort of thing. So in other words, the point is, it's not just that you arrest six illegal alien construction workers. If they are in debt bondage, you're actually breaking up the infrastructure that makes that illegal flow of workers possible by doing this.
Yes, you're cutting off a business opportunity for the traffickers, right, and for the cartels.
So what's another area? So that was public safety.
Just one
related.
More thing I'd like to say about the job issue. And that is one of the really frustrating things about the illegal employment problem is that so many employers have been able to insulate themselves from accountability for hiring illegal workers by using labor contractors and staffing companies and kind of washing their hands knowingly of the illegal hiring and the other problems that go along with that. And they've been able to escape accountability. They just move on. You know, if they get busted for illegal hiring, they blame it on the staffing companies or, you know, the lazy or, you know, incompetent HR people, when in fact they know what's going on. And I think that a lot more states need to look at either updating their laws or using provisions that exist within their laws to hold these employers accountable. For example, in Florida, they have some language in their law that refers to willful blindness on the part of employers. Hmm. And in other states, the terminology is reckless disregard.
Right.
And so I think that state authorities need to look at using this language more aggressively or inserting language like this in their state laws to enable them to go after the employers who know exactly what's going on, are the ones making huge profits off of illegal labor and wage suppression. And, you know, when they start going after some of these employers under these terms, I think that that will get the attention of a lot more employers and don't allow them to hide behind these staffing companies.
Yeah, because it's not even just on immigration, but on other issues too.
Yes.
They essentially outsource the legal risk of hiring a 12-year-old or what have you to these fly-by-night labor contractors that, you know, then go out of business and the guy who was running it starts a new company with a different name.
Mm-hmm. And many times they are actual traffickers.
Right, yeah.
Posing as staffing company.
Makes sense. So, interesting. Okay. What else can states do?
Well, once we understand, you know, the way so much of illegal immigration is run by criminal enterprises, cartels, smugglers, traffickers, and so on, then it becomes, you know, important to try to attack this by following the money.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of this is the flow of remittances that migrants send back to their home countries. Oftentimes it is, you know, illegal workers, you know, just sending money home to their families to help support them or to save up for, you know, what they think might be their eventual return to build a house for themselves or what have you.
Sure.
But also present within this flow is the criminal proceeds of illegal immigration. For example, it's becoming more well understood that these remittance flows are also hiding flows of payments made to traffickers, for example.
Like paying off their debt, in other words.
Exactly. Like when someone's here working illegally for an employer in an arrangement that was put together by the smugglers to, you know, pay off the smuggling fee.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, the worker has to send the money back to Mexico or Central America. They wire it back using, you know, Western Union or a number of other money transmission services. And so it's really not money to support a family. It's they're paying the smuggler.
Interesting.
This is how they're collecting their fees.
Right.
In other cases, the cartels and other crime organizations will hire immigrants as money mules and, you know, go have them deposit small amounts of money repeatedly in multiple transactions in order to avoid the reporting requirements that we have for these transactions. So the Western unions are sort of, you know, actually serving as the money laundering for these illicit proceeds. And so it's important for states to look at how they can regulate this flow of money out of the country. Florida, in its recent grand jury investigation, uncovered that something like $5 billion left the state of Florida for abroad through just a handful of the money transmission services that operate in the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, this is not you know, hardworking migrants sending money back to mom and dad in the home country or to their family that they left behind. This is a massive flow of money that's linked to organized crime as well. And so what Florida is looking at doing is imposing a fee on to skim off some of these transactions to use for law enforcement, much as Oklahoma did in pioneering this approach, you know, looking at all this money flowing out of the state and saying, this is, you know, this is not good.
Right.
So Oklahoma, I think, makes about $12 million a year in fees that it imposes on overseas money transmissions. And Florida is looking, and some other states are looking at doing that as well. But I think it's also important for, if states are going to do this, they need to recognize the way that this flow of money is also used for organized crime and impose know your customer requirements on it as well. And what I've recommended is that states require that a verifiable form of identification be required for money transmissions to be made out of this country. And that way, it would cut off access to this money transmitting to illegal aliens who don't have that kind of identification. And it would also allow law enforcement agencies to track who is making these transactions.
Sure.
Like, does Joe go down to the Western Union, you know, every Monday, Wednesday, Friday and send, you know, $1,999 out of the country? You
right.
know, so that's not likely a regular remittance. That's not going back to his little town to, you know, pay for diapers for
right.
the child he left behind. This is his job to do this.
Interesting.
So I hope more states will start looking at this really key link in the illegal immigration that keeps it flowing.
And the fact that the state treasury can make some money off it seems to me a
yes.
sweetener, you know, to get them maybe more likely to actually do it, because Oklahoma has a 1% fee, but it's a kind of, it's almost like a tax withholding, because in Oklahoma's case, when you file your tax return, you get all that back. It's sort of, you know, you're kind of prepaying your taxes, if you will. And if you're not filing a tax return, if you're, say, a drug dealer or an illegal immigrant, well, then that's how the state keeps money. So it seems to me there's a sweetener there. So what other role can states play in trying to limit illegal immigration?
Well, one of the most horrifying types of illegal migration that's happening is the unaccompanied minors.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are minors and because they become so vulnerable to human trafficking, labor trafficking, and gang recruitment and all sorts of other things when they get here. And a lot of this is made possible because of the very lenient placement process that the federal government under the Biden administration has. Their goal is to simply, when minors arrive, under the law, they have to be turned over to HHS.
It's Health and Human Services.
Right. Department of Health and Human Services, led by Xavier Becerra, and released to a sponsor. And under current HHS policies, they want that release to come as quickly as possible with as few questions asked. And as a result, there are about 90,000 kids who have been released that the federal government has lost track of because they require only minimal follow-up to the sponsors to make sure that the kids are in a safe situation and that they're not working at the Cheerios factory and that they're, you know, not being trafficked for commercial sex or, you know, not hanging out with a gang all day.
Right.
This is their great monitoring process, is a phone call to the sponsor. And in more than 90,000 cases, they have not actually been able to make contact with the sponsor to make sure that the kid is okay.
And frankly, even when they do, what do they say? Is the kid okay? And the sponsor says, yeah, everything's copacetic. Fine. Have a nice day.
Right. You know,
I mean, even that's not really monitoring in any meaningful sense.
It's not. It's really concerning. This violates every standard that every state in the union has for foster care placements, for example.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But again, this is an area where that is not only important for states to look at because of the implications for the kids. Florida has found that about 400 of these unaccompanied minors run away from their sponsors every year and end up as wards of the state child welfare agency. Hmm. And I'm sure this is happening in other states as well. So what they're kind of pioneering an approach to getting control of this. And so as a result of the year-long grand jury investigation on this, they are proposing changes to state law to make the sponsors come forward to the state. And if it's someone who is a parent, claiming to be a parent of one of a minor who's crossed illegally, they are requiring them to prove that relationship to the satisfaction of the state. And if they've been released to someone who is not a parent of the minor, then that individual has to appear before Florida officials and actually become a legal guardian of that child or face potential criminal prosecution. And the idea here is to send a message to the trafficking organizations and others that are misusing this system that they're not going to be able to get away with it in Florida. And so the hope is that it won't be happening there anymore.
Right.
Which I think every state in the union ought to be doing.
Right, right. We're bumping up against time. You also wanted to talk about NGOs and contractors. I think that's an interesting issue because it came up in the news recently in Texas.
Yes. One of the really important groups of players in illegal migration nowadays are these NGOs who are involved either as contractors working for the federal government to transport and shelter illegal migrants, or groups that have set up themselves independently as shelters. And what is becoming increasingly clear is that in many of these situations, these contractors and NGOs who are involved are actually crossing a line from providing humanitarian assistance or services that are paid for by taxpayers, but also actually appear to be inducing illegal migration, potentially harboring illegal migrants, and in some cases, assisting them in fraudulently applying for immigration benefits. And so a lot of states have been struggling with how to deal with this. They see what's happening. But now there's a very interesting case in Texas where the attorney general identified one particular NGO called Annunciation House in El Paso and has sought to shut them down on the grounds that they are essentially operating a stash house for illegal migrants. They're concerned that they are counseling these illegal aliens on how to fraudulently apply for asylum and profiting from this enterprise from taxpayer funds that are provided by the state and federal government. So they did an investigation. They saw that Annunciation House was bragging in the local news media about how they were assisting specifically migrants who had evaded the Border Patrol. So this is not people walking up to the Border Patrol and, you know, turning themselves in, which is the model for a lot of this now. But these are the gotaways that they are bragging about assisting.
Wow.
And talking about the counseling that they do to help them apply for asylum. And that this has really crossed a line here. And they are serving something like 300 people at a time. And so the state is opened an investigation, has asked the courts to shut them down so that they can determine what exactly is going on there. And the group, of course, has gotten lawyered up with every, you know, open borders NGO in Texas and beyond.
Right.
But this case is now being pursued, and I think really is something that other states should look at, how the NGOs are operating within their state, and use your licensing authorities and other state laws to make sure they're not crossing the line into abetting criminal activity.
Right. Basically, to make sure that they're not knowing links in the smuggling conspiracy, as opposed to just, you know, handing out you know, bottles of water to people who happen to be or in the area. You wanted to talk some, we're running long here. You wanted to talk some about what you had heard at the sheriffs, the Western Sheriffs Association, about sort of their approach to, or their concern for how they're going to react to federal immigration policies and what have you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The sheriffs are emphasizing how united they are across the country in different size sheriff's departments, different size law enforcement agencies, different types of communities at the border, within the country, in frustration about this ongoing border crisis instigated by the Biden administration, and especially in pushing for a solution to this problem.
Mm-hmm.
The sheriffs came out against the recent supplemental spending bill that the Senate put forward, believed it was not a solution to the border crisis.
This is that so-called Lankford bill.
Yes, the right. Lankford Sinema Murphy bill, mm-hmm. that was shot down, rightfully so, because it was not a border bill. It was a catch and release bill, and they recognized that. And they're concerned about this because of the implications for public safety. They want to emphasize that. They're looking for a bipartisan solution, not just because of crimes committed by illegal aliens, like the Lake and Riley case. And they actually scoff at the media narrative on illegal alien crime rate studies, which they know are completely contrived and irrelevant to the situation. For example, Sheriff Mark Daniels of Cochise County, Arizona, which is on the border, said that a few years ago, border-related crime was 5% of all the crime in his jurisdiction, which is high enough. Now, in the last 3 years, it's risen to 44% of crimes in his county are related to illegal migration at the border. And more importantly, they understand this connection between the open border and illegal immigration and organized crime problems in America that the public, I think, is less aware of, the connections to the cartels and the gangs and the Chinese crime syndicates. And they're very upset that President Biden has yet to meet with a single sheriff to talk about this problem. And they've issued a letter that's expressing their hope that lawmakers will set aside partisan differences and focus on the solutions to this border crisis. And they're making a big push for this in the coming year to demand an end to the border crisis.
Interesting. So it's sort of a bottom-up demand. It's not just like New York City's demand for more money. This is a locally based demand that the problem, the source of the problem, actually be addressed and the illegal immigration be shut off.
Exactly. And they want the country to know that, and they really are trying to send a signal to lawmakers that they need to do something about this.
Okay, well, on that note, we will wrap it up. Thank you, Jessica Vaughn, who is speaking to us from the Western States Sheriffs Association? What is it?
The Western States Sheriffs Association.
Right. Yeah, it's conference in Reno, and it's been talking about some of the things that local and state governments can do. We're going to have some links in the show notes. Jessica's written about this a good deal, as have other people here at the center. So thank you, Jessica, for taking time away from the conference, and I guarantee you we'll be talking about this more in the future.
Great. Thank you, Mark.
That's it for this week's episode of Parsing Immigration Policy. If you have any complaints, suggestions, whatever commentary you might have, please just email us at center@cis.org, and I hope you will tune in for our next episode.